from Psalm 1. Happy are those who reject the advice of evil people, who do not follow the example of sinners, or join those who have no use for God. Instead, they find joy in obeying the law of the Lord, and they study it day and night. They are like trees that grow beside a stream, that bear fruit at the right time, and whose leaves do not dry up. They succeed in everything they do. But evil people are not like this at all. They are like straw that the wind blows away. Sinners will be condemned by God and kept apart from God's own people. The righteous are guided and protected by the Lord, but the evil are on their way to their doom.
And from James 3. Are there any of you who are wise and understanding? You are to prove it by your good life, by your good deeds performed with humility and wisdom. But if in your heart you are jealous, bitter, and selfish, don't sin against the truth by boasting of your wisdom. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven. It belongs to the world. It is unspiritual and demonic. Where there is jealousy and selfishness, there is also disorder and every kind of evil. But the wisdom from above is pure first of all. It is also peaceful, gentle, and friendly. It is full of compassion and produces a harvest of good deeds. It is free from prejudice and hypocrisy. And goodness is the harvest that is produced from the seeds the peacemakers plant in peace. This is the word of God for the people of God. So I have to say I'm a little nervous this morning. So I'm going to start with a story just to break the ice. A sales rep, an administration clerk, and a manager are walking to lunch when they find an antique oil lamp. They rub it and a genie comes out. The genie says, "I'll give each of you just one wish." Me first," says the administration clerk. "I want to be in the Bahamas driving a speedboat without a care in the world." And poof, she's gone. Me next," says the sales rep. "I want to be in Hawaii relaxing on the beach with my personal masseuse, an endless supply of pina coladas, and the love of my life." And poof, he was gone. "Okay, you're up," the genie says to the manager. The manager says, "I want those two back in the office after lunch." Moral of the story is, our desire is not always the one that matters most. So, little confession, when I was preparing for today, I thought I had picked the right version of the Bible when I was pulling the scripture, but I didn't. And honestly, after reading it before and then just now, I was like, man, that would have been a little bit easier to draw from. But anyways, so this is a little bit slightly different version of James 3 that we just read. "Who is wise and understanding among you? Show by your good life that your works are done with gentleness born of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not be boastful and false to the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, and devilish." When I hear the words bitter envy and strife and selfish ambition, if I were going to describe myself, I wouldn't choose those two words first. That doesn't sound like us, right? And it's not something that we want to be. But then, as I was thinking about this, I thought back to a conversation I was having with a friend in passing the other day. And he asked if I was living the dream. It was a passive question, just one that we ask each other in passing, right? Like, instead of how's life, how's it going, all of that, it's like, are you living the dream? And I remember saying it a lot when I was just like a few years younger, not too much younger. But then I started thinking about it more and more. And I thought, what dream are they referring to? And the one that comes to my head first is the American dream. Because that's the one that we're living in America and we're all dreaming the same dream. It must be the American dream. So I apologize, I'm about to talk about the American dream, but I thought it was appropriate. So according to Wikipedia, the great almighty Wikipedia, the American dream is a national ethos of the United States. the set of ideals, democracy, rights, liberty, opportunity, and equality, in which freedom includes the opportunity for prosperity and success, as well as an upward social mobility for the family and children, achieved through hard work in a society with few barriers. That doesn't sound that bad, right? Like, the American dream sounds okay at this venture. But there's, like, the definition that we want to believe is true, and then there's the commentary of what we kind of feel that it is. And so I look at great American literature that sometimes picks apart some of the things that we take for granted and tries to define it for what it really is. And some of the great literature, like The Great Gatsby, Of Mice and Men, Death of a Salesman, and Requiem for a Dream, all have their own take on the American dream. They describe it as a dream being built on success, materialism, living off your hard work, and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. George Carlin talked about the American dream and alluded to it as the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it. The American dream, to me, as I was growing up and cosplaying it within the last decade, was always understood as making something of yourself off the hard work of your parents. In essence, it was to build something equal to or greater than your parents' success. It is not necessarily something I set out to achieve, but I have learned a lot from my parents. The examples and mistakes that they have made and shown me, here's what's best in life. I don't know what the American dream means for you, but just take a second to consider it. So when I heard my friend ask this question, I went back to my previous reflections on this idea. My reflections on this idea of society's American dream in the past are ones that seem closely tied to James 3. If I were to ask myself the societal meaning and premise behind the American dream, it would sometimes seem that it could be surrounded by bitter envy and selfish ambition. I'm not saying that everyone that has achieved the said American dream is filled with envy and selfish ambition. What I am trying to get to is more of a question of where does the glory go for the work that we do? And whose resources are those that we get off of our work? So James 3 continues. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there will also be disorder and wickedness of every kind. So let's go back and look more at what American dream has produced in our society. If bitter envy and strife has the result of disorder and wickedness, now we have something to compare. Where's the American dream got us in this country now? So when I look at news and social media, this is what I see. This is my perspective. It's not God's truth. It's just my perspective. It's a nation where people don't trust the news, where the news can't always be trusted, where people hate others because of skin color, wealth, political stance, the state that they live in, or their position of authority, where every generation blames the other one for their lot in life, where self-protection is what we need against our neighbors, and where religion is used as a reason to judge people based upon their decisions in life. Now, is that all that America is right now? No. But I can't get on Facebook sometimes these days without seeing this in the majority of what I read and see. So why do we act this way? Why on earth would America, the country founded on biblical principles, enter into a country where there is so much discord and disunity? The Gospel of Mark records this story for us. Leaving that region, they traveled through Galilee. Jesus didn't want anyone to know he was there, for he wanted to spend more time with his disciples and teach them. He said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of his enemies. He will be killed, but 3 days later he will rise from the dead." They didn't understand what he was saying, and they were afraid to ask him what he meant. After they arrived at Capernaum and settled in a house, Jesus asked his disciples, "What were you discussing on the road?" But they didn't answer because they had been arguing about which one of them is the greatest. When the disciples were traveling with Jesus, and Jesus wanted to teach them more, and Jesus tells them a story about how he's going to be killed by his enemies, they didn't seem fazed, because they were confused by Jesus' words. But instead of asking Jesus, like, what did you mean by that? Like, how are you going to die in 3 days? They were too busy arguing about who's the greatest amongst themselves. These disciples always seem to be missing the boat, right? They seem to be blockheads, according to Charles Schultz. But are they acting much different than we do? Do we ever, as followers of Jesus, wonder if we are going to be seen as more holy because of our actions than the person a few pews in front of us, in the Sunday school down the hall, or even at the church down the road or across town? Do we ever think that our way of viewing the Bible is better than theirs, just because it seems to be the only way of thinking about it? Do we ever wonder to ourselves if we are the only ones getting it right? I was talking with another friend of mine, honestly, on the same day in the same room, just two different conversations. And he said, if only people just thought like I thought. I don't think anyone in this room has thought that, right? Immediately, my thought went to, sure, if people thought like I thought, that'd be great. I just wouldn't get stressed out, wouldn't have all this stuff going on that like I have to deal with, it seems like. But then where would the fun be in that? Now, of course, it was a well-intentional millennial asking me this question. Yes, I'm one of those two. Ish. But aren't we all thinking this at some point in time? Haven't we been scrolling through Facebook and seeing crazy people saying crazy things, linking crazy articles, showing crazy videos all the time? If they would just see the world how I see it, the world would be such a better place. And honestly, I wouldn't have to like throw my phone against the wall so much, which I don't. That would be irresponsible. But anyways, don't we sometimes think that if people would just read the Bible like I read the Bible, we would all get a pat on the back from God and life would just be better? Now, of course, we would never say that out loud, especially to the people that we want to say it to the most. But I'm sure we've all thought it just a little bit. So what does being a part of God's kingdom really look like? James 3 continues, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy, and a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace for those who make peace. Peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without a trace of partiality or hypocrisy. So how do we become something that we are not naturally ingrained to be? We live in this world that's so messed up that really we have to look out for the good of ourselves and our family, right? God just can't ask us to give up our need for physical security and financial stability. The question I'm led to with this is, then am I living in the right world? If God wants me to be gentle and willing to yield, why this world? The world seems to walk over people who are gentle and willing to yield. If you find someone willing to yield, you just plow right through them and get on your merry way, because that's one less person you have to worry about. And peaceability, that seems to have gone out the window a long time ago. For my generation, it was 9/11. For another, it was Vietnam. And for another, it was Pearl Harbor. For the teenagers today, it seems to be the school shootings. So how are we supposed to show our enemies mercy and goodness? Then I'm hit with the all-encompassing question of, am I standing in God's presence when I ask those questions? When I read the Bible, and see people in God's presence, their faces are usually in the dirt. They are so filled. Yeah, it's like how my daughter says my name. Anyway, sorry. They are so filled with fear and awe that their body gets thrown to the floor. They don't care about those who have offended them. They care about the overwhelming reality that they have offended the being who is greater than all other beings. Being in God's presence is hard. It's not easy. But Moses, Elijah, Jeremiah, Isaiah, and all the rest saw the world a little differently when they were in his presence. But God doesn't show up today like that, right? Burning bushes, bright lights, earthquakes, dreams. I have not heard of God showing up like that recently. However, that seems like we get off the hook, right? Like we don't have to be faced. However, I think it is because we have something far greater than all of that. And let me read you a story. Brother Lawrence was born Nicholas Herman in modern-day eastern France. There was a lot of towns in the... I didn't know them. As a young man, Herman's poverty forced him into joining the army, which guaranteed him meals and a small stipend. During this period, Herman claimed an experience that set him on a unique spiritual journey. He fought in the 30 Years' War and following an injury, left the army and served as a valet. In June 1640, Nicholas joined the Carmelite Priory in Paris. He entered the priory as a lay brother and took the religious name Lawrence of the Resurrection. He made his solemn profession of vows on August 14th, 1642. He spent the rest of his life with the Parisian community, where his primary assignments were working in the kitchen and in his later years repairing sandals. Despite his lowly position in life and the priory, his character attracted many to him. He had a reputation for experiencing profound peace, and visitors came to seek spiritual guidance from him. The wisdom he passed on to them in conversations and in letters would later become the basis of the book, The Practice of the Presence of God. The conversations had been conducted and recorded by a notable cleric, the Abbe Joseph de Beaufort, who compiled this work after Brother Lawrence died. Multiple times in his letters, he said, "Don't show this to anyone else." His death on February 12, 1691, occurred in relative obscurity, but his teachings lived on in the compilation of his words. So here are some of his words told to us by a witness to a conversation with Brother Lawrence. "He told me that all consists in one hearty renunciation of everything which we are sensible does not lead to God. And we might accustom ourselves to a continual conversation with him, with freedom and in simplicity, that we need only to recognize God intimately present with us, to address ourselves to him every moment, that we may beg his assistance for knowing his will in things doubtful, and for rightfully performing those which we plainly see he requires of us, offering them to him before we do them, and giving him thanks when we have done. That our sanctification did not depend upon changing our works, but in doing that for God's sake, which he commonly do for our own. That it was lamentable to see how many people mistook the means for the end, addicting themselves to certain works which they performed very imperfectly, by reason or their human or selfish regards. That the most excellent method he had found of going to God was that of doing our common work, without any view of pleasing men, and, as far as we are capable, purely for the love of God. That it was a great delusion to think that the times of prayer ought to differ from other times, that we are strictly obliged to adhere to God by action in the time of action, as by prayer in its season. That his prayer was nothing else but a sense of the presence of God, his soul being at that time insensible to everything but divine love. And that when the appointed times of prayer were past, he found no difference, because he still continued with God, praising and blessing him with all his might, so that he passed his life in continual joy, yet hoped that God would give him somewhat to suffer when he should grow stronger. That we ought once for all heartily to put our whole trust in God and make a total surrender of ourselves to him, secure that he would not deceive us. That we ought not to be weary of doing little things for the love of God, who regards not the greatness of the work, but the love by which it was performed. That we should not wonder if the beginning we often fail in our endeavors, but that at last we should gain a habit which will naturally produce its acts in us without our care or to our exceeding great delight. That the whole substance of religion was faith, hope, and charity, by the practice of which we become united to the will of God. That all beside is indifferent and to be used as a means, that we may arrive to our end and be swallowed up therein by faith and charity. That all things are possible to him who believes, that they are less difficult to him who hopes, that they are more easily to him who loves, and still more easy to him who perseveres in the practice of these three virtues. As Brother Lawrence proceeded in his work, he continued his familiar conversation with his Maker, imploring his grace and offering to him all his actions. It's a 27-page book. It's worth the read. So what can we learn from a man who devoted himself to being in God's presence? You give your all for the all. Brother Lawrence gave up a normal societal life and went to a priory. This was a place where you separate yourself from the day-to-day things that you need to do to make a living and have a house and support a family. Is that what God is asking of all of us? I don't think so. So what does giving your all look like? You give all for the glory of God. You give being a wife to the glory of God. You give being a husband to the glory of God. You give being a father and a mother for the glory of God. You give being an employee or an employer to the glory of God. You give being a son or daughter to the glory of God. You give being a friend and a neighbor to the glory of God. Really, any label that you've given yourself, that you've worked to achieve, whatever your life is built in, you just give it all to the glory of God. Giving all does not mean giving up. It means your motives for living are not to make yourself better, but to make the presence of God known to everyone you are in relationship with. The one way to do this is to be in God's presence, praying without ceasing, as Brother Lawrence did. When we are in God's presence, his presence radiates to our surroundings. But that's a little too much to ask, right? Like, God's really not asking us. That is why Psalm 1 says, "But their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law they meditate day and night. They are like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its seasons, and their leaves do not wither. In all they do, they prosper." And at the end of the day that Jesus had with his disciples, he said, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." Then he took a little child and put it among them, and taking it in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." So coming to God as a child seems to be what we're supposed to do, but why? We're going to watch a little video.
Do I touch it?
Yeah, go ahead. What is it?
All right. What's your favorite food ever? This is tough. Salad, mac and cheese,
pancakes, and popcorn.
My dad's steak,
pizza. So good.
What food do you dislike most? I hate cheese.
Vegetables. Spinach. Tomatoes.
What's a face you make when you eat raw tomato?
I don't eat it at all.
What do you do when someone gives you food you don't like?
Play with it until it got cold.
I'll say, hey, what's that? They look that way.
Because if it was gross, then why would I want to eat it?
Did you know that 1 out of every 5 kids doesn't have enough food to eat?
1 out of 5. 1 out of every 5 kids.
Can you turn the bag around and look at the other side?
Oh. But I didn't know it was in America.
I don't know what to say to that. Makes me feel bad. Makes me want to cry. Wow.
That's a lot of kids.
It's kind of unfair because some people have too much stuff and some people have too little.
For me, I always get to eat lunch. And if that's a meal that I'm missing, I would feel very disappointed.
Makes me feel like, what are we going to do to fix this?
What is something we can do to help fight hunger together?
So over there we have a wall with tons of ideas, and we want to add your idea to the wall.
Kid could think, oh, that's not possible, or oh, I'm too young to do this. But it is possible, and you're not too young to do it.
Donate money as much as I can.
Make Thanksgiving every day.
We should all get a group and try to find the foods that would be easiest to give.
And we can take the food to homes where they don't have food.
That's a small way to have a big effect.
Post videos about children not being able to eat.
Everyone brings canned food and they build a big fort. And then they donate all the canned food.
And then they can have everything for free.
If there was a machine that could make food, my machine would change it to 0 out of 5 kids being hungry.
The tiniest ripples make the biggest waves. If all the kids in the world got together and did something big, they could impact the whole world.
So that could be my transition in talking about the crop walk that we're doing next Sunday, but I'm not going to. I encourage you to look at the crop walk that is going to be happening next Sunday and see if it's something you want to be a part of in one way or another. But the point of that video for me this morning was start asking a kid, what's your favorite food? What's your least favorite food? What do you do when someone puts your least favorite food in front of you? And they were so focused on their preference. But the minute they saw someone else's hurt or pain, they forgot about themselves. And this is why Jesus says that when we accept a child, we become his presence in their lives. When we welcome the idea of putting ourselves as a servant to all at the forefront of our minds, we are welcoming God's presence in. When we blot out all envy and selfish ambition, we enter into God's presence. And when we are in God's presence, it is only natural that his presence radiates out of us and into those around us for his glory and only his glory. Loving God is where it starts. Doing everything for God's glory is the action, and caring about others 100% is the response to our action. So today, before we enter the world that's out there, that makes all of this very hard, that's riddled with the appearance of defeat, take the time during this last song to lean on each other. Enter into God's presence this morning with each other and be reminded that we are not alone on the journey. Just as Brother Lawrence had his fellow Carmelites and believers walking the road towards God with him, we have the people in this room next to us to lean on. It is not easy to give up the desire to be the greatest, but this is what God is asking of us today. So right now, as Sherry sings this last song, I want you to turn to each other and pray with each other. And encourage each other in that prayer to welcome in his presence.